The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmn.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Gateless Gate, Master Wu Men's Gateless Gate, case 20, a person of great strength, the main case. Master Zungwan said, "Why is it that a person of great strength cannot lift their leg?" Again, he said, "It is not with their tongue that they speak." Wu Men's commentary. Of Zungwan, it must be said that he emptied his intestines and turned his belly out. Yet no one understands it. Even though there's a person who immediately understands it, I'll give them severe blows with my stick if they come to me. Why? Look, if you want to know pure gold, see it in the midst of fire. Wu Men's poem. Lifting their leg, they kick up the scented ocean. Lowering their head, they look down on the four jhana heavens. There is no place to put this gigantic body. You please, add another line. So, welcome to all of you who are joining us this morning. We've this weekend been doing an introductory retreat online. So, those of you who are with us this weekend are with us this morning. And I really noticed during the weekend in the sessions and conversations, quite a number of you seem very to be in the midst of a very strong motivation to be very sincerely seeking the Dharma, and some of you have been practicing for some time, but expressed being at a point in your lives, in your practice, where there's the hunger for something more. And that's very important. And it's important to respond to. As I was saying to one person, you know, if we don't go to work, if we don't clean our house, if we don't cook food, if we don't take care of things, things fall apart pretty quickly. We see that. And so that there's a clear impetus, motivation, to take care of that and the consequences if we don't. Spiritual practice can appear much more subtly. And so it can appear as though it's more incidental or optional or, you know, what we get to if there's time. And that's why it's so easy to get lost. You know, it doesn't take a lot of talent to get lost. It's harder to find, to keep on track, to stay on the path, to return when we wander, to even recognize that we're wandering. And so what to do with that energy of bodhicitta, that very precious sense that there's more to this life, that just living day to day and taking care of the necessary things is important, but not enough. When we begin to recognize that samsara seems easy, but it seems to get harder. When we begin practicing, that seems hard, but we should have faith that it will get easier. And so what to do with that energy is training, is to apply it skillfully. And so the Buddha said that there were certain key aspects of our consciousness, our mind, our being, that are the most powerful forces we have in our world. Not only to find our own peace and fulfillment and clarity about the nature of things, but also to be a genuine force in this world for good. And the Buddha said those factors are things like mindfulness and concentration or samadhi, compassion and loving kindness, insight into the real nature of things. And so every form of practice in the Dharma, certainly in our tradition, is either directly cultivating that or is leading to the cultivation of that. The koan in our training is a way to also take that energy, that inquiry, that deep yearning to understand and very directly and powerfully apply it into the koan, into a question, an essential question. And for the koan student, we have to learn how within our meditation to do that. Just like every student needs to learn how to direct their attention to the breath. It sounds simple, but we encounter all manner of things that seem to make that difficult and obstruct it. And so the koan is employing that mindfulness, that concentration, that compassion, that non-attachment, that aspiration. Because otherwise, if we don't direct it, then it just stays sort of like raw energy, raw materials, if you will. They can either just get distracted away, frittered away, or they can be misapplied to things that aren't actually going to help us. And that's what a lot of samsara is about, is the misapplication of very important qualities and energies and forces and powers that we have. And so here in this koan, Master Zhongyuan asks such a question. Why is it that a person of great strength cannot lift their leg? Also, it's not with their tongue that they speak. And so there are all kinds of strength, of power, physical strength, emotional strength, intellectual, verbal, artistic. And very often when we apply ourselves in one way, we cultivate that particular strength, that particular power, but others not. I remember working when I was in high school in several animal hospitals and seeing among some of the doctors, not all of them, but some of the doctors who were very good at relating to animals, not so good with people. When I was in music school, some of my peers were excellent musicians, but not always good performers. I see in popular culture people who are pretty good performers, but not very good artists, from my perspective. In Buddha Dharma, the Eightfold Path, the Eight Gates, in our training, we are cultivating that great strength throughout the whole body and mind, throughout the whole of our lives. We're basically learning how to be a Buddha, how to be an enlightened being, how to bring forth wisdom, how to bring forth compassion. And the way we do that is by doing it. So if we want to cultivate compassion in our lives, we have to be compassionate. We have to practice compassion. We have to practice it in all kinds of situations, in situations when it seems that compassion is nowhere near, that it's not in us. We have to practice wisdom when we seem as far away from wisdom as we might be able to be. And so here, a person of great strength could certainly lift their leg. They certainly use their tongue to speak. So what is Zhongyuan saying? He's obviously speaking on another level. He's speaking about another aspect, another way in which we function, in which we exist, in which we are. So the student takes this koan into their meditation and makes it the focal point of their meditation. They have to become that person of great strength who does not move their mind, who does not come and go. Now, how do they lift their leg? A student once asked Master Dongshan, what is the proper way to ask and answer a question? And Dongshan said, when it doesn't come from your mouth. This is part of what the student of koans is learning, is how to take language. And usually the power of the question seems to be in the words and the meaning of the words. but they're just words. The real power is when it is a question, which means it's something that lives within us. And that is the heartbeat of Buddha Dharma. When it doesn't come from the mouth, Dongshan said, it's not about the meaning, it's not about understanding, it's not about knowing, it's not in the words. And yet we use words to free the mind and body of what we might think of those ordinary powers, those ordinary sources of strength, so we can discover this great strength that Dzogchen is speaking of, that arises out of our mindfulness, out of samadhi, that comes forth through right understanding, right speech, right action, right effort. It's really the great power of the self liberated from the self. The heart liberated from fear. The mind liberated from clinging and false views. It's what Master Dongshan spoke of in the five ranks of Dongshan when he's talked about the third rank of coming from within the real. The poem for that says, within nothingness, within emptiness, within non-abiding, non-clinging, there is a path. It leads us free from the dusts of the world, from everything that seems to entangle us. Hakuin says, this allows us to bring forth and let shine the marvelous wisdom that understands the unobstructive interpenetration of all dharmas. It's really the beginning, in our lineage, is considered the sort of the beginning of really cultivating compassion, coming from selflessness. It's what Master Dzogchen is speaking of here. In the commentary, Wu Men talks about Dzogchen emptying out his intestines, turning his belly out, and he's really talking about the compassion of the teacher who holds nothing back. The Buddha said throughout his life, he said, I teach with an open hand. He says, there's nothing that I have concealed or held back. And in that, the teacher, as is in this koan, the teacher is trying to, in a sense, bring us to a precipice, bring us to the limit, the boundary that we perceive that is the self that holds us back, that binds us, that makes what is so clear so opaque, that makes what is simple so complicated. And that precipice, and if we look back, we see everything that we know, that we cling to, that we desire, our expectations. And before us, we don't know. On that precipice. That's what makes it a precipice. When we look forward, we don't know what we see. Or if we see, we don't know what it is. And the question is, how do you leap forward? It's not a matter of will, and yet it takes great effort. In that commentary, Wu Men says, yet no one, Dzogchen empties out his belly, but no one understands it. Another translation reads, but those who follow need to make it their own and carry it forward. And that is so important. We practice together as a Sangha. We sit together. We train together. Characteristic of the Zen tradition is we wake up together. We go through the day together. And yet all along the way, on every seat right now, is a person, you, who can only do this within yourself, to make it your own and carry it forward. And making it one's own in our popular culture doesn't mean to just follow our desires. And to make something my own often means to appropriate it and to put our sort of signature of the self on it and then turn around and sell it or market it or something. To make it our own means to walk hand in hand with the Buddha as an ancestor, to walk with the Dharma. And in that, it becomes our own. It becomes something that is no longer a teaching or a text or a sutra or instruction that's coming from the outside, but it's your own voice, it's your own mind, it's your own knowing. Shibyam in his commentary said, with this koan, the why is a person of great strength unable to lift their leg? He said, with this why, Zunguan is urging you to completely cast away the self and the whole universe. When the self is empty, when we realize the self is empty, there's nothing that would restrict the self. When we realize that the self doesn't abide, doesn't exist, what would restrict it? It's like restricting open space. On the contrary, Shibyama says, so-called free legs will cause the self to stumble. That is the free legs of our desires of doing whatever we want to do. And so, as is so true in so many different disciplines, there is a discipline, there's a rigor, there's a following of tradition, if you will, there's a practice that we have to engage in over and over and over again. Right? When I was studying musician, you practice the music of the ancestors, right? If you're studying composition, you learn to write in the style of your ancestors, Bach, Beethoven, Mozart. And in that way, you're sort of walking that path and learning how to make that your own so that it becomes more integrated, more wise, and then it becomes yours. And now you can carry it forward. It's very much the same in Buddhist practice. Shibyam says, by seeming to deprive you of everything or taking everything away, Zunguan expects you to revive, come back to life as a truly free person of great strength, and to develop your life unconstricted as an enlightened being. He tells the story, Shibyama tells the story of the centipede who... somebody who was doing fine until somebody asked the centipede, how do you manage all those legs? And it looked back, all those legs, and from then on, it couldn't take a step. Right? It's sort of like when we begin practicing the breath. We've been practicing all our life, and suddenly it becomes very complicated. The self, self-consciousness, right? We begin to stumble over ourselves, which is sometimes just the necessary beginning stage of learning how to be aware. And in that, we see our stumbling, we see our anxiety, our doubt, our confusion, all of it. And as we are studying this self, if we're paying attention, we look around and we see that the same thing is happening everywhere. And within the Sangha, it's happening amongst noble friends who are also examining. And as we look beyond the Sangha, we see other people who are doing it in their own ways, in their own paths, and own traditions, but we see many, many people who are not doing it at all. And so we see, like ourselves, but we see others who are caught in false views and beliefs and convictions and passions. And these days we see so many who are caught in such things without any credible basis. In other words, they're not actually connected to even a relative truth, we might say. The Buddha said, all conditioned existence is dukkha, leads to disappointment, dissatisfaction, is impermanent, and it all arises from desire. And so when we look at the turmoil of the world in individuals, in groups, what is being desired? What is being sought? Recently, I've read several different articles that were just each separate articles, but in my mind, they began to stitch themselves together in a thread. There was an article about on the anniversary of the attack on the Capitol, our nation's capital, last year. There was, of course, a lot in the news about that. And I read an article about a mob. What creates a mob? How does a mob come into being? I quoted one federal judge who was hearing a person who was part of that mob and wondered aloud, how is it that people who have never had any interaction with the law are suddenly morphing into terrorists? How does that happen? So the article went to the Center for Study of Hate and Extremism and asked that question. Go to the experts. And someone said, in the right circumstances, even those with a weak attachment to any extremist view can become violent. And I think that the important phrase there is in the right circumstances. Right, of course, in this case means wrong, the wrong circumstances. But the conducive circumstances that take a weak or incipient extremist view and fan it into a raging fire. And then they went on to say responsibility gets diffused across the group. And you have the immediate lure of peer validation plus a cloak of anonymity. And so in that, what I hear is a desire for acceptance, a desire for connection, a desire for belonging, all important things, a desire to have purpose, but becoming toxic because it's not grounded in reality, not a true reality. It's not grounded in compassion. And very importantly, there's, just following this response, lack a cloak of anonymity, it's lacking personal responsibility. That it's like the self is given over to the group, and now the group is responsible. It's like when I was a young person, and on a few occasions when I got into trouble, and my parents would sit me down and in one way or another ask the inevitable question, if everyone walked off a cliff, would you? And in my young mind, I thought, probably. They were trying to get me to think for myself, to be my own person, to take responsibility, because we cannot abdicate that, in fact. We can pretend to, we can hide it under a cloak, but that's just hiding. There is no abdication. Karma is or belongs to the person who acts. That can't be given away. And so the right circumstances can give rise to nascent tendencies and strengthen them, make them stronger. That's what the Buddha was talking about in right effort. And when those are based in unskillfulness, are based in greed and anger and hatred and division, those we should see, those who care about this world, who care about other people, should see those getting stronger and should immediately address that to make them weaker, softer, diminish them, let them pass away. But we can do the exact same with compassion, with understanding, with skillfulness, and bring forth great compassion. That's what the Eightfold Path is. So the Bodhisattva is somebody who sees that there is no one else to take responsibility. It's my fault. And it comes down to each and every one of us. When we realize that the self is empty, that it's not bound by anything, that there is only this moment of experience and perception and action, then the abdication of responsibility or trying to merge it into a group, a tribe, is an illusion. The same thing can happen in a Buddhist Sangha, right? I can feel good that I am here simply because I'm here, and because I'm here and all of you are practicing, I must be practicing. But that's not necessarily true. And so that's why within the Sangha there has to be both the solitude, the person, you, each of us, on our cushion, finding our own way and carrying it forward, and the community together. But the question remains, what is being desired in all of this? For those who are bound by desires, acting out of impulses, reactions, not even necessarily understanding why. So I read another article. And this was about, it was talking about sort of the epidemic or pandemic of anger. You know, these crazy, ludicrous, but not surprising conflicts that are erupting on planes, in stores, on the streets. And this one was about a grocery store. Somebody comes in, an older guy, he wants a particular kind of cheese, it's not on the shelf, they demand, the clerk goes back to get it, the clerk comes back and says they can't find it, and he goes into a rage. And when they interviewed the clerk, she said, have you seen a person in their 60s having a full temper tantrum because we don't have this particular kind of cheese that they wanted? And then she said, I'm looking at someone and thinking, I don't think this is about the cheese. And then the commentary, because the article, they always go to get some expert opinion, said that the problem is the disconnect between expectation and reality. That people, consumers, have been seduced into the idea of a frictionless economy, which means you can get whatever you want, whenever you want, without waiting. Bad idea. And when that doesn't happen, guess who gets upset? So being conditioned and being led to believe that this is a right, this is the way things should be, then there is disruption, there is anger. And not understanding that, not examining our minds, not taking responsibility, naturally, it's somebody else's fault. You're making me angry. So, what is being desired? If it's not about the cheese, what is it? So I thought of bell hooks, who recently passed away, a very important writer, speaker, thinker, practitioner. And she was in a book called The Will to Change on patriarchy. She said, and I thought of that because I was just thinking of that mind of domination, of control, of wanting to control. And dukkha is basically a system that is based on control. When the Buddha said, you don't get what you want, or you get what you don't want, or you don't get to be with who you want to be with, or you have to be with who you don't want to be with. These very simple ways of expressing universal experiences. And in not getting those things and not understanding, we strive to get those things, which basically means we try to control and dominate our world and others so that we get those things. And that leads always and predictably to unhappiness and a lot more. And so she says, patriarchy is a political social system that insists that men, males are inherently dominating, superior to everything and everyone deemed weak, especially females, and endowed with the right to dominate and rule over the weak, and to maintain that dominance through various forms of psychological terrorism and violence, to maintain it in whatever ways are necessary to get what is desired. And then she says, we cannot love what we fear. And she didn't make the direct connection, but she was making a different connection. But in our attachments, in delusion, there's always fear. Always fear. Because it's all based on a shaky ground, which is a false view. It's all based on an understanding that is not true, that is not reliable, that will disappoint us, will lead to dissatisfaction, we will feel betrayed. And the easiest thing to do is just to keep trying harder, get more angry, more controlling. And of course, we see that movement, not just in our society, but in the world. The allure of someone who will be that patriarch, that dominating, controlling force, who will tell us what to think, so we don't have to think. And to see how appealing that is. How appealing that is. And what I hear in bell hooks' words are, that means we'll find it harder and harder and harder to love each other, to be compassionate. Even to the people within our tribe. And then there was another article that was about a city council person who was having just a kind of what they thought was a routine meeting in some Midwestern town about a mask mandate, and was shocked at the eruption of responses and the rationales for why masks should not be worn. And went home thinking, what is going on? It's not about the mask. It's not about the cheese. What is it about? What is being desired? And the article said that in many ways, acknowledging this is not simply about masks or schools or vaccines, in many ways, they said it's all connected to a much deeper rupture that is getting to the most fundamental questions a society can ask itself. What does it mean to be an American? What does it mean to live in this country? Who's in charge? Whose version of the country is right? Right? When we talk about the country, our country, what country are we talking about? What even is a country? Social scientists that they talked to said that conflict, who study conflict, say that the only way we can begin to understand this and move through it is to look at the powerful currents of human emotions that are the real drivers. Oh, it's not about the cheese. It's not about the mask. Could it be about the fear? Could it be about the anger? Could it be about uncertainty? This includes the fear of not belonging, a sting of humiliation, the sense of threat, real or perceived, and the strong pull of group behavior. Said that in ongoing intractable fights and conflicts, people in those conflicts often don't even remember how it began, what it's about. It's like the hungry ghost. The desire becomes the thing itself. It's no longer the desire to be satisfied. It's just desire itself is the driving force. Conflict itself becomes the driving force. And like any repeated experience over and over and over, it becomes an identity of a person, of a group. And so if there isn't conflict, if there isn't anger, if there isn't fear, that is perceived as wrong. Something's missing. And so something has to be done to recreate that, bring that up again. And then there's a kind of calming within that familiarity. The Buddha said it is most decidedly not about the cheese. It's not about what's out there. That was his radical, profound enlightenment. That was his profound insight. And it's not unique at all. But his insight into the inner workings and what do we need to address? What do we need to be paying attention to? What energies do we need to be examining and cultivating? And what are those that we need to be freeing ourselves of? He realized, in short, that all suffering in every form that we bring upon ourselves and we bring upon others, which is the only way suffering comes about as we create it, arises from the sense of a separate self. All of it. We should reflect on that. Is that true? Is that possible? Why is it that a person of great strength cannot lift their leg? For one who has turned inward, who has examined, who has seen into the nature of this mind, this heart, this being. When we realize there is no self now, what is there that restricts us? When we see ourselves or others caught within an intensity of restriction that takes innumerable forms, we see it, and this is the view of the Bodhisattva, we see it as a creation of the self, which is creating one's own suffering in their very attempt to be free of that suffering. And it's a heartbreaking truth. It's heartbreaking because everybody suffers and it is so unnecessary. And in a sense, probably every spiritual religious tradition ultimately rests in the sense that somehow the grief of human experience is not necessary, can be liberated. But how is that to be done? So these struggles for power, control, or dominance that we see, the perception of threat, who is being threatened? In every struggle to win, to gain, to succeed, it's always fragile, always tenuous. It will come apart. It will ultimately fail. That's why the liberators so frequently become just the next tyrant. The Buddha said the only way is to go all the way into the ground, to go all the way into the center, and realize there is no place to put this gigantic body. When the self is released, liberated from the self-constraint of our mind, of our thoughts, of our views, of our attachments, it is that simple and it is that entangled. And it's so difficult because we are so bound to all of that. It is what we know. It is what we have used. It is what the world is. And to release that, even when we know it's not working, even when we know it's causing our suffering and that we're creating it, it's still hard. But for practitioners, we can look and gain understanding and see the workings of karma, see the manifestations of unexamined minds, see these misguided applications of our desire to simply be at peace, to simply love this life, to be connected and belong. We see all of these actions as these very just sort of upside down attempts. They can be so upside down that they don't even remotely resemble striving for well-being. A student once asked Master Dungshan, "What is the most tormenting thing in the world?" And the student said, "Hell. Hell must be the most tormenting thing." And Dongshan said, "No. When that which is draped in these robe threads, these clothes, is unaware of the great matter, that I call the most tormenting thing. When we don't understand this life, who we are, our mind, when we don't understand what arises and what appears inside of us, when we don't understand the nature of the conflicts that we experience, when we don't understand the cycles that repeat themselves over and over," Dongshan says, "that is the most tormenting thing." And so, how fortunate to encounter this Dharma, to encounter a path that so profoundly understands this and provides a path, gives us a way that anyone who chooses can engage at any level. And as I spoke about yesterday with those of you in the retreat, what we want to learn and will learn if we continue in the practice is that there is no situation, internally or externally, that cannot be practiced, that we cannot bring wisdom to, that we cannot bring compassion to, that we cannot bring non-attachment to. None. Because the power lies within us. It's not in the circumstance. And that's just another way of saying that everything is workable. There is no inherent restriction. And so that's why Buddhism and the Bodhisattva is never pessimistic, right? Is never defeated, never gives up. Because they know that no matter how, in what darkness we may descend, in what intractability we may seem to reside, that can change in an instant. And it does. It happens. It's happened to us. And to me, that's just a testimony of the goodness that resides within us, of the basic nature of Buddha that we are, of the impermanence of things. And so that's why it's so important that there always be sanghas, Buddhist sanghas, Jewish sanghas, Christian sanghas, agnostic sanghas, spiritual but not religious sanghas, whatever. Wherever you find yourself, if you are with noble friends who actually want to bring something good into this world, consider yourself fortunate. And then do that. Let that be our work. Let that be our purpose. Let that be our contribution, our dana. And yes, it will seem slight and insignificant much of the time. But when we consider that there are good people everywhere, everywhere, doing good work everywhere, when we realize how profoundly we are not alone in that. James Baldwin, in his book, The Fire Next Time, wrote, "Love takes off the masks that we fear we cannot live without and know we cannot live within." And I use the word love here not merely in the personal sense, but as a state of being or a state of grace, not in the infantile American sense of being made happy, deserving to be happy, entitled to be made happy. It is about the cheese. No, he says, but in the tough and universal sense of quest and daring and growth. Love that is tough and universal and seeks and has courage and grows. How does a person of great strength lift their leg? Zungguan says they cannot lift their leg. Why is this so? Free of the self, free of the idea of the body and its constrictions. How do they lift their how is it that they cannot lift their leg? Which is another way of saying, how do they lift their leg? How do they speak? How do they love? How do they live this life? Well, in Wu Men's poem, he speaks of this great power. Lifting your leg, you kick up the scented ocean. Lowering your head, you look down on the four jhana heavens. There is no place to put this gigantic body. You please add the next line. So, being such a person, following such a path, if you choose, make it your own and carry it forward for yourself and for all of us, because you can do that. We can do that. That's what the Buddha, that question, the Buddha laid to rest 2,500 years ago. We don't debate that. That question is not debated in Buddhism because it's settled. The question is, how are we doing that? And so being such a person, I would invite you then, you please, add the next line.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.